meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. It is 1:02 p.m. on Monday, March 6th. Joining me at the table right this moment, because we finished floor a little bit late, Representative Parrish, Representative Tallarico, Vice Chair Westlake, Co-Chair Josephson, and myself, Representative Garantar. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Summers Cole. Thank you both for being here. Before we get into the presentation for today's hearing, if members as well as attendees could please silence their cell phones, we would greatly appreciate that. And I was just provided a note that we were provided with an updated slide presentation at 12:30. It's a little different from the one that we received this morning, so hopefully the bill sponsor can point out the places where there are differences, and then we will get that uploaded to basis as soon as possible. Please let the record reflect that Representative Birch has also joined us. Today's hearing is going to be on House Bill 133 by Representative Guerra, and so and we're just joined by Representative Drummond. Please note the record at 103. So if Representative Guerra could please come join us at the podium.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Please begin.
Thank you. Members of the chair, or members of the committee, co-chairs, I appreciate you hearing House Bill 133. House Bill 133 is sort of our best attempt at making sure we find a way to get a fair share for our oil so that we can have a stable ability to fund schools, even fund the payment of oil tax credits, fund a university, and move this society forward. My view on a fiscal plan is that everybody needs to chip in, but if we focus on those who have little and don't focus on those who do well, then it's not balanced, and that's one of the purposes of House Bill 133. The other purpose is what it says in the Constitution, which is that we're supposed to develop our resources for the maximum benefit of our people. And we believe HB 133 draws a balance between meeting that constitutional mandate and also treating industry fairly. Just from a 30,000-foot view, we have fields in the state that we are supposed to be living off in terms of raising revenue that are allowed under current law to pay a production tax of zero, and there are many fields that will pay zero for their first 7 years. And then the bigger, higher tax-paying fields, which until about $74 a barrel, 50% higher than the prices we have right now, pay a 4% tax. That's it. That, I think, in combination with the very generous tax credits, is sort of a double whammy that the state is facing. Very low production taxes, and then tax credits that this year will eat up all of those production taxes, so we get a negative production tax, and in future years get us very little net production tax to fund our schools, our university, and a future.
Pardon me, Representative Guerra, for interrupting. I just want the record to reflect that Representative Rauscher has joined us. Thank you.
Here's the 0% problem, and this is drawn from a report by the Department of Revenue. There are fields that we call GVR fields. Those are fields that that were unitized in 2003. There are a number of definitions, but basically they're most post-2003 fields, and they're all future fields. If ANWR were to open, this is the tax the fields in ANWR would pay. And we've been told many times that that's our future. Well, were ANWR to open tomorrow, the tax that would be paid by a field in ANWR, whether it was a blockbuster field or not, would be zero. That would be the production tax, all the way up to $70 a barrel for 7 years. During some of the most productive years of those fields, they would pay a 0% tax. That's the tax we level on GVR fields. By $90 a barrel, we would get one of the lowest profits taxes in the world, a 12.2% profits tax. That's the way the GVR provision works. There are three different ways you can get this very low GVR tax. Basically, one was, in my view, designed for Point Thompson. Point Thompson was a field that the state had fought to get developed for decades. Finally, there was a settlement in about 2011. where Point Thompson was required to move ahead with production. So Point Thompson, primary owner there is ExxonMobil. They get the benefit of this 0% GVR tax for their first 7 years as long as oil remains below $70 a barrel. That's what we'll get from Point Thompson in production taxes, zero. There are three other types of fields, future fields, post-2003 fields in many cases. That's just the laws we have right now. The laws we have right now, you know, when we debated Senate Bill 21, and there's don't really want to have a debate about that. There are parts of SB 21 that make sense. There are parts of ACEs that make sense. I'm not one that says we have to choose one or the other. I think that's a debate we don't need to have. We need to learn from what we've done in the past and come up with an oil tax bill that makes sense for everybody. And if we don't learn from the past, we don't get anywhere. The current law right now, up until about $74 a barrel, and North Dakota was presented years ago as the standard we should be shooting for. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but just using that argument from years ago, in Alaska we have a 0%, and these are for the big fields, like Prudhoe Bay. We have a 0% tax until $15 a barrel. Companies aren't making money. A 1% tax, a little bit above that. It gets to the 4% tax that we have at $25 a barrel, and it doesn't get higher than 4% from $25 a barrel for the next $50 of oil price rises to $74 a barrel. It remains on the average North Slope field, that 4% tax. In North Dakota, even at $10 a barrel, the tax is a 10% gross. In Louisiana, it's a 12.5% gross. I think there's a very good argument that we shouldn't really be comparing ourselves to North Dakota and Louisiana. I'm not here as a geologist. I could play one on TV, but I'm not here as an international tax expert. I could play one on TV. But I can tell you, really what we've heard in testimony is we should be comparing ourselves to big basin places around the country, around the world. And we're not really competing with North Dakota and Louisiana. I only mentioned that to let you know what a couple of the other states in the lower 48 do. They raise substantially more revenue at every single price than we do all the way through $74 a barrel, the prices that we'll see in the next many, many years.
Let the record reflect that Representative Johnson has joined us.
The way the production tax works right now, in this coming fiscal year, we will take in not the sort of historic about $6-7 billion in production taxes as we in production taxes and royalties as we have in the past, but we'll take in about $225 million in production taxes. But after you pay out tax credits to companies, we'll actually be $25 million in the red. We'll pay out more in credits than we'll get in production taxes. By fiscal year 19 and 20, when all of those cook inlet tax credit changes have taken place, under current law, even though we'll take in theory, around $250 million in production taxes, we'll give back about 60 or 70% of that to the industry. So our net to the state will be about $100 million, $150 million in 2020. That's far short of what I think we should be generating, especially as prices get higher.
Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I just have to ask, as I was looking through this and not delving into entirely, but are you saying that, or are you referencing here that our production is up, our production, I mean, that the oil tax credits appear to be working, our production is up for the first time in 14 years. Maybe we're not supposed to be comparing ourselves or competing against North Dakota, but from my latest reading, I believe Exxon said they were going to be looking to $40 a barrel oil for production. So, I mean, we do have to maybe keep that in mind, and that includes some of the large basin areas. But anyway, so this tax is only a portion of the equation.
Through the chair. Yeah, let me just address that briefly. You know, under the old ACES system, we had a very high tax, and we paid out very generous credits, right? Under the current law, we have a low tax and pay out very generous credits. Under ACES, before it passed in 2012, the fields that you see right now moving forward under ACES. E&I came up here. Armstrong came up here. Repsol came up here. There's a really interesting quote from a Repsol press release before they were offered tax breaks. And they came up under ACES saying, Alaska has great geology. It's a stable place to do business. We're going to invest $750 million, and we're going to move forward with those fields that are economic. And we have seen some of those fields announced. But I don't think that there's a field. If there is, there's maybe one. I don't think there's a field that wasn't moving forward before Senate Bill 21. And our goal is to increase oil production, though the forecasts are that it's going to continue to decrease over the next 15 years, unless there's a major find, and we're hoping for major finds.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. You said it will continue to decrease. What part is continuing to decrease?
According to the Department of Revenue and Natural Resources, their forecast for oil production is a decrease over the next every year, almost every year through the next 20 years, down to about 300,000 barrels a day, I believe, under current law.
But follow-up? Thank you, Madam Chair. But that's not what's currently, that's not what we're currently experiencing.
Through the chair, certainly you can. The Department of Natural Resources has their forecasting model. I think there's 1 year where oil production isn't going down, and then it continues to go down. Really, very similar to all of the forecasts we've had for the last 10 years.
Representative Birch has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does any of this incorporate the royalty share in other words, if you do get down to 300,000 barrels a day, if you have a 1/6 royalty share, I'm assuming that 50,000 of those barrels are state of Alaska owned, but is any of that state asset that is made possible by as a result of this production, is any of that represented in your presentation here today?
Through the chair, Representative Birch. No, right now we're talking about production taxes. We do get on some fields a 12.5% royalty, on some fields roughly a 16% royalty. And we'll address the royalty a little bit as this presentation goes on, but right now we're talking about, people when they talk about the old ELF system and the PPT system and the ACES system and now the SB 21 system, that's all the production taxes. So we're going to focus mainly on the production tax, but we'll address the royalty too.
But yeah,
follow-up.
Representative Birch. Yeah, but I think it's fair to state that if you at some point if the you need to account for that production and the fact that as a 1/6 or a 1/8 owner of oil that's produced, I think we need to recognize and understand that is a key component of our revenue picture. And I think anything that we can do to increase the either throughput or see an uptick in production, I think is a good thing. And I recognize that we can have a lot of discussion around the credits, and I welcome the discussion, but I think we never need to get our eyes too far off the ball, which is what do we need to do to ramp up production, increase production, invite additional exploration and development.
Thank you.
And also want to recognize that Representative Reinbold has joined us.
All right. Thank you.
Please continue.
So this is from the Department of Revenue. This shows what our effective tax rates are under the current system. There are the bigger Prudhoe Bay type fields. Those are called the non-GVR fields. We've been told by the Department of Revenue, we'd look at the bottom slide. We basically have what's called a greater of system. When the profits tax under SB 21 current law is greater than the 4% minimum gross tax, then the profits tax kicks in. If you look at the bottom, the Department of Revenue projects that will happen somewhere around $73 or $74 a barrel, where we'll generate more money on the profits tax version of current law than the gross minimum part. So that's the prior slide that you saw, that we're at a 4% tax on the Prudhoe Bay type fields until $73, $74 a barrel. If you look even at $80 a barrel for the Prudhoe Bay type fields, under current law, we've got a very minimal 13.1% tax, and for the next 10 years of oil price forecast, we don't go much above $80 a barrel. And so I believe you would hear if you asked, is a 13.1% production tax in the lower end of what is charged around the world. I think you would be told it is. If you look at the GER fields, the ones with the lower tax rate, they, for the first 7 years, if prices are below $70, not pay a production tax. Where price is $80 a barrel, their production tax is about 40% lower than the non-GVR fields. So the newer fields, the ANWRs, the fields you hear about, talked about, they pay about a 40% lower tax rate for their first 7 years, or if there are 3 years of $70 prices, then for 3 years. But those are low tax rates. I mean, it's all in the eye of the beholder. I don't think that we can move the state forward at a 0% production tax on GVR fields and a 4% tax on non-GVR fields for prices that go up to the $70 range. We've been told by the Department of Revenue, if you look at the revenue source book, the uplift cost, the cost for producing a barrel of oil right now on the North Slope are about $40. And here's what I call the 4% oil tax problem. The left side is the current law. Up until about $73 a barrel, tax rate of 4%. HB 133 says, let's just recognize company profitability. The average field on the North Slope is profitable at about $41 a barrel. Let's not raise the 4% tax to 5% until $50. And then at every $8 increment, raise it by 1%. The analysis that we have that we can get you from the Department of Revenue is that the state share, as you go from 5% at $50 to 6% at $58 to 7% at $66, still not approaching the North Dakota tax or the Louisiana tax, these price-sensitive and profit-sensitive increases will still leave the industry with a larger share in revenue than the state takes. We're just trying to get a more fair share. So that is one component of HB 133, a price and profit sensitive gross tax that goes up very modestly as prices go up.
We have a question from Representative Johnson, then Tallarico, then Rauscher.
I'll pass for now.
Okay. Representative Tallarico.
I was just thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Guerra, I was just wondering, you have North Dakota and Louisiana here again. Do you have any information on what their royalty share is or what their municipal property tax rates might be that they would pay in those, just so we can compare apples to apples?
Thank you. Through the Chair, Representative Tallarico, I do, and we'll have that in a slide. I think if you ask Mr. Ajira, what he would tell you is the royalties, the private royalties, because those are states usually where oil is being produced on private land, the private royalties in those states are much higher than the state's royalty that we get in Alaska, and their acreage leasing costs are much higher than we normally get when we bid out a field, when we lease a field through the bid process. And I'll get to a chart on some information we have. It's very hard to have complete information on what every single private landowner charges for a royalty, but they tend to be much higher than what Alaska charges.
Follow-up, Representative Tallarico.
So in those areas, is there a state take?
Through the chair.
Maybe insignificant.
Through the chair, Representative Tallarico, their state take, if it's not on state land, they don't get a royalty. The company pays a royalty, but they just pay it to somebody else. They don't pay it to the state.
Okay.
Yeah, and just one more follow-up, Madam Chair. Were you able to get any municipal taxing information? I know we have some municipal tax. That's mostly property tax and stuff, just to keep our line viable and everything. But
through the chair, Representative Tallarico, every state is different. North Dakota has two different taxes that we would consider a production tax. They call one a severance tax, and one, I can't remember what the other one is they call, but it adds up to 10% on the gross. And it's very hard to compare state to state, but your experts can give you sort of what they call government take, though I think what they should give you is government take plus private take also, because in a lot of the states, the royalty goes to a private landowner. The company pays it. They just don't pay it to the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the representative from from the eastern side of the Richardson Highway addressed a lot of the questions I had, which were basically how royalties fit in with all three of those scenarios there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Guerra, one of the things we've been saying is trying to say non-producer share to be the reflecting these different circumstances where it's the state or the private landholder, if that helps at all, because we've been trying to do that. Representative Rauscher, did you have another comment?
I'm good. Thank you, Madam.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just looking at slide number 9 where it says average break-even point. Now, is that what does that include in that? What are you including in that number?
Thank you. Through the Chair, Representative Johnson, if you look at the revenue source book, they have both the cost of transportation and the cost of production. And those total, when you add them up, for the most recent year we have information for about $40.21. The sort of lease expenditures and transportation.
And follow up?
So thank you, Madam Chair. And so you're not is that including the tax? What are you including in this $40.21? Is that
the cost of development is about $40.21, and that I believe is before the taxes. But you could ask Mr. Alper, who's here, who would be able to confirm that.
Yes, that is before. That's the gross value at the point of production. After that is after the transportation costs, and then the other part, I think down here, $30 and something is the lease expenditures. So those two components. And then the production tax would be 35% off of the number. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Guerra, I share your concerns about the 4% up to $74. But on your slide 11, you show this bill would provide a 10% gross at 90, and aren't we getting a higher percent under SB 21 at 90?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, by $90 a barrel, the current law shifts over to a profits tax. So is a 10% on the gross bigger than 14% profits? Probably, but if there's a field out there, it's field sensitive. There might be a very profitable field that is at a 20% tax rate at $90 a barrel. But our bill does the same thing the current law does, which is when the profits tax is bigger than the gross tax, the profits tax kicks in. So were the profits tax to be larger than 10% on the gross, the profits tax would kick in. This would not stop that from happening.
Representative Birch.
I'll back on slide 10. Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we're kind of centering some of our discussion on credits, if you look at this slide, the second line from the bottom, it says North Slope credits applied against total tax liability. It identifies a $225 million credit. Are not those credits an expenditure that was incurred in the production of the revenue that's realized in the line above? In other words, a gross revenue. I mean, it seems to me like that's a part of the cost of doing business. The credits basically are a representation of the expenditure that was made necessary for the exploration, development, and realization of the revenues that are derived out of that field. Are they not?
Through the Chair, Representative Birch, you know, the tax is on top, and then you get the credits back, Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with your point.
Okay, so I mean,
follow up, Representative Birch.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, that is the point, that it's the credits are basically they can also be realized as an expense against doing business. I mean, if you open up a business someplace and you know, there's a, you know, certain costs are incurred in the operation, the day-to-day operation, and the startup of that business, and I guess my understanding is that the credits relate to basically an expense. It's an expense that was actually incurred in the production of and the realization of the oil asset that is flowing through TAPS.
Through the Chair, I think that's accurate. What this chart does not show is the additional credits that we pay for that we give to companies that are not producers. But
right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just taking a look here at page 8 and page 10. And I was just wondering if you'd run through this because it doesn't look like the numbers are the same. The transportation is 933. Here it's 977. I guess. Let's see. Lease expenditures, 3364.
I think there's a $2 difference. You're right, and we meant to ask about that. I think Mr. Alper would be able to answer that. I've assumed it's been a typo, but I could be wrong. So that would be something for Mr. Alper to answer, why the 977 and the 3364 are about $2 different than the numbers on page 10.
And I think Representative Josephson has a comment, and having had a conversation recently on this topic, what we learned was it just reflects sort of there's a lag in time between the industry activity and the change in prices. So right now the industry is contracting in terms of operating expenses by layoffs and then pulling back in capital expenditures. So the higher number was from the fall forecast for 2016, I believe, and that's reflected in the note on slide 8. Those numbers, though, have been updated for FY 2017. Ken Alper is saying no. Okay. We'll get information from him at some point.
Through the chair. Both say they're from the fall revenue forecast of 2016. Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer as to why there's a $2 discrepancy, mm-hmm. and you might ask Mr. Alper later on.
Okay, thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment that the number of around $40 to $41 is the number, I think, that was provided at the Alaska Oil and Gas Association luncheon in January. And I think for purposes of explaining the bill, it works as well as anything. It's not an audit-specific number, but it's workable for explaining the bill, I think.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
I mean, thank you, Madam Chair. I just think it's important to kind of get our facts sorted out here so we know, so we're all talking about, you know, we're all working on the same sheet of music, so to speak. So the other thing is I was just wanted to note that Department of Revenue has said that sometimes it's as high as $46. It's a break-even point.
Mm-hmm. So the break-even point changes from field to field. At Prudhoe Bay, it's probably a lot lower than it's going to be for Luna. Size of the field, the age of the field, the infrastructure, each field is going to be different. This is the department's best assessment of the average cost for a North Slope field over the life of the field.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Well, that's what I understood, too, is that we were talking about the average, so I was hoping that we weren't picking individual fields and going off those. So all of these numbers we've talked about, both the $46 barrel, or all of them, include from Department of Revenue, also the one that I see on page 10, and referenced on, I think, page 8 and page 9, as they all kind of go together. It would be nice to have them noted notated so we could know what they were actually referring to and why there's such a discrepancy between them.
Through the chair.
Representative Kerr.
I'll be able to answer a lot more of this as we go on in the presentation, but the basic point of HB 133 is to not start the progressive gross minimum tax until above the point where a field is profitable on the North Slope. There are ways to adjust that and to fix for that, and I'll address royalty relief later on. But you cannot have an exact tax. You never had one under ELF or PPT or ACES or SB 21, and that's why we have royalty relief to adjust where the tax law just isn't going to be perfect for every single field. But that's why we didn't raise the 4% minimum until 50, above where the average field on the North Slope is profitable, and we slowly go to 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 to try and recognize company profitability and the impact that price plays on company profitability. Can I proceed, Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
This is just a comparison of the tax rate that we would levy as a minimum tax under HB 133 if you compare it to North Dakota and Louisiana. It's just a chart that shows the numbers that you've seen already. Much more conservative than what they're doing in those other states. Again, those aren't probably the perfect states to compare Alaska to. There are other states with lower tax rates. And frankly, we're really competing not with shale oil states, but with states that have big traditional pools of oil. Places around the world that have big traditional pools of oil. And you can hear that from our oil tax experts. But it's a much more modest tax, even with the raise, than we see in what used to be sort of touted as the model state, which was North Dakota.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, again, why aren't we competing with shale oil states?
Through the chair. There are some companies that try and produce both. It's a different technology. The shale oil tax rate, given the price intensiveness of drilling well after well after well, some of those wells last for 2 years, should probably be reflected in the tax rate there, but it's not for me to tell North Dakota what to do or Louisiana what to do. I think what I hear, what I've always heard from tax experts is we're really competing with those other jurisdictions with the kind of pools of oil that we have on the North Slope.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just from my reading this morning, and so Exxon being one of our major Alaskan producers, in the statement they were saying about shale oil production, looking to develop shale oil at $40 a barrel, that sounds a lot like direct competition to me. And I guess I just have to put that out there.
Through the chair.
Mm-hmm.
I guess then we should probably, then Exxon is okay, I guess, with the North Dakota tax rate, which is much higher than what we have if we're competing with North Dakota. But look, this is for certainly the committee to assess. If you believe that we're competing with North Dakota, we have a much lower tax rate than North Dakota does. If you believe we're competing with Louisiana, we have a much lower tax rate. If you believe we're competing with Norway, we have a much lower tax rate. There are places you can find that have lower tax rates than we do. I think in the end, we're supposed to come up with a tax rate we think achieves the maximum benefit to the public as the Constitution requires. And that's a combination of oil revenue for the oil that we own and making sure we have production too.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. So the longest regime we had in Alaska was much criticized. It was called the ELF tax. Under ELF, before it ended in 2005, the tax rate on Prudhoe Bay was, the gross tax was 13%. On Alpine and North Star, it was about 10%. That was the majority of our production under the old ELF. Under the old ELF, which was criticized as being too generous to industry, we had a tax rate on those fields that was much higher, double and triple the rate we have right now under current law. In fairness, under the ELF, a number of fields paid nothing in terms of production taxes, smaller fields, older fields. But Prudhoe Bay, the places we had got the majority of our production from under ELF, we paid a much higher gross tax than we do right now. The question came up about royalties, and Madam Chair, what did you say you called the rates that the companies pay to everybody combined that's not the state?
Non-producer share.
So the reality is that the producers, they will take home what they get after they pay everybody else, right? In Alaska, that's largely the state. In other states, that's the state and private landowners. While our normal royalty in Alaska is about 12.5%, in Texas, though, according to Mr. Ruggiero, it's now up to 20 to 30%. The Competitiveness Review Board, the report that we got in 2015, back then the average Texas royalties were 12.5 to 30%, depending on the landowner. Mr. Ruggiero says they're now 20 to 30%, according to the landowner in Texas. California, 16 to 25%. North Dakota up to 25%, Oklahoma up to 20%. The royalty share and also the land lease payments in those states tend to be much higher than they are in Alaska.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I had understood, I believe, from Commissioner of DNR that most of the leases that are going out now are 1/6. A royalty share is 1/6 or 16 and 2/3, whatever 1/6 works out to. And some of the legacy fields, the older ones, are the 1/8, which would be the 12.5%. Yet, has that been your experience as well, or are you?
I mean, yeah.
1/6 sounds better as an owner than 1/8, I guess, as a royalty share.
Through the chair. I think there are a number of 1/6 fields that we have now. Prudhoe is a 12.5% field. That's our biggest field, right? Kaparik is a 12.5% field. I think the general view of the Department of Natural Resources, but you can hear from them, is on the fields that are more promising, they charge a higher royalty. It's a contract, basically. Companies sign the contract. And the more likely that the field is going to be a generously profitable field, the more likely it is the royalty rate is going to be higher. Oddly enough, under current law, you basically lose the benefit of the higher royalty, because there's a provision in the current law that says even for those more generously profitable fields that you have a 16% royalty on, we just give you the money back in a lower production tax rate. So it's a wash right now under current law.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
I think so.
As I tried to allude to before, and Representative Birch is correct, there's also the royalty. And so what happens if under the ELF system or the old PPT system or the ACES system or the current law or any new law we adopt, what happens if we think we got the tax right and there's a particular field where we just didn't get the tax right and it's not profitable? We have what's called royalty relief. That's the repair mechanism to make sure the overall tax the state charges, production taxes and royalties, are not too high. A company comes in, they prove the field is not economic, they're not going to be able to move forward under the current royalty system, and they get most of the royalty waived. Or DNR could issue a royalty order that says at low prices we'll waive most of the royalty. It's very flexible the way they can do it to make the field economic. The last three applications I know of, Ugaruk, Nikaichuk, and the field by Kalis, Nuna, those have all been granted royalty relief. So for new fields, the royalty, the 12 to 16.5% royalty, can be reduced all the way down to 5% to make a new field economic. If price costs on a field, which I think would include a change in taxes, if costs to a producer change, a company can come in and say, you know, I've had an existing field, I've had a producing field, but now I need royalty relief. And for those fields, the royalty relief can go all the way down to 3%. So basically, 1/5 of the 16% royalty is what we would get if at the bottom level if DNR determined that's what's needed to keep a field economic. That's again the fixing mechanism we have in the law. The royalty relief statute is at 3805-180, and that explains it. Royalty relief, like I said, was recently granted to Nuna in 2014. It was granted at Ugaruk and at Kayachuk, and those are the last three that I know about. This is just a page. Here are a few pages just out of Conoco's earnings reports. Conoco is the only oil company that reports its Alaska profits. BP sort of does, but doesn't. They're not required by the SEC to do so. Conoco is, because of the amount of its production that comes from Alaska. Under SEC rules, no other company has that requirement. BP lists what they call Alaska profits, but it's really not. They're really not Alaska profits. There was one year where they deducted the cost of the Deepwater Horizon spill from their Alaska profits. That I don't know how BP does theirs, but they're not truly Alaska profits. So that's the point: is you can't look at the Alaska line in the BP reports. They're not required by the SEC, and they're not really Alaska profits. But Conoco's are. Fourth quarter of this past year, Alaska was one of its highest generating regions in the world. $116 million of profits for the fourth quarter. They lost money overall. Around the world, but Alaska has been because of probably our larger pools of oil, because of their interest in Prudhoe Bay and Alpine and some of the more profitable fields, has been among their highest profit areas in the country. Higher profit than the lower 48, higher profit than Canada, higher profit than worldwide. Back when oil was at higher prices, their profits in Alaska tended to be about the $2 billion range on an annual basis, going back to 2010. This is a very small chart, but it shows basically by fiscal year 19, were this bill to be adopted, it would generate about $200 million in additional revenue. What this bill or any bill will produce in additional revenue is going to depend on price. The projection is that by 2019 we'll be at about $60 a barrel. From a revenue standpoint, we're hoping that these price forecasts will go up, but we're really in the 60, 70, high $70 range until 2024.
Let's just stop for 1 second, make sure no questions, because we just blew through those slides. Representative Birch.
I just had a question, it kind of to the larger issue of tax credits and inviting new development. And as I recall, your initiative on the area of credits and trying to encourage smaller investors, I think has been fairly successful. If I'm not mistaken, I mean we've seen smaller players in the field. How does that weigh into this? I mean, as far as the credit program that encourages small explorers, I mean the Great Bears, we've seen half a dozen of them. I mean, do you view that as successful?
Through the chair, so I'm going to leave that to this committee, which is viewing a credit bill. My personal opinion is that when you have a tax system that generates a large amount of money, you can afford to be an investor in new oil fields with very generous credits. When you have a tax system that's generating almost nothing, you can't afford to do that. Whether those credits lead to new production, a company will always say that. Do we know that's true? Possibly, possibly not. And I know this committee is looking at that. I am not one for taking somebody who receives money at face value when they say that money was really good to me and really important. They will always say that. You should have some independent experts that tell you whether or not they're working. I'll tell you, in Louisiana, their credit is basically a two-year credit on horizontal drilling from 1994, when horizontal drilling was new. And you can only take the credit for the cost of a well, and you can only take that for up to 2 years, and if you can't deduct it within 2 years, you can't use it. It has been testified when I've been around that no other jurisdiction in the world has the same combination of low tax revenue take and high credit payments as Alaska. Alaska is unique in the world in that combination of the revenue it generates and the credits it pays. But you have been studying this issue for many weeks, so I think you know a lot about it.
Thank you. Thank you, okay. Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Please continue.
Thank you. So, again, I have no interest in sort of going back to the ACES mechanism or debating whether ACES was better than SB 21. The maximum profit take under ACES on the production tax was about 75%. It was sort of a Norway level of government share. HB 133 is going to do better at low prices for the state where we are right now and not as well at high prices. It's a compromise that says you can't be the highest in the world at low prices and the highest in the world at high prices. It's modest on both ends. There's a second feature of the bill. If you recall, the profits tax for GVR fields can be next to nothing, below 10% at very high prices, around 10% at very high prices. For non-GVR fields, until about $90 a barrel, we're hovering around the 10-12% range. Those are very low profits taxes. Those are profits taxes that, even under the somewhat maligned PPT tax system, that was a 22.5% tax rate. ACES was a base 25% tax rate. There are very few profits jurisdictions around the world that have a 12% profits tax. Maybe jurisdictions with very poor pools of oil, but not many. So this HB 133 maintains the current approach, which says the state gets paid the higher of either the profits tax or the gross minimum tax. Whichever is higher is the one the producer will pay. But we looked at it and we said, you know, the state, if oil prices go up to $90 a barrel, are we going to live off a 13% profits tax? And I don't think we can. I don't think it's fair to the residents of the state. I think it's too generous to industry. So we've imposed a new sort of higher of minimum tax, and that would be, we will still have the mechanism for determining the profits tax under the current law, but it can't go below an effective rate of 22.5%. You can deduct below that your credits, but having an effective tax rate of 9%, 11% at $90 a barrel, 13%, doesn't seem sustainable to me. And so we've adopted a very modest 22.5% profits tax as the higher of tax that that would be imposed when it's larger than the gross minimum tax. We also have something that we borrow very much from what Governor Parnell introduced as his first effort to reduce the tax on ACEs. And what he did was called bracketing. He said at some point companies are in windfall profits range. And look, we're not even close to this right now at today's prices. But if you're going to pass a bill, you shouldn't change it every couple of years. And so we also take into account what happens at high prices. And what Governor Parnell had proposed was this thing called bracketing. The criticism that opponents of ACEs made was that as the tax rate went up, that applied to the tax on all oil. So if the tax rate went up to 50%, all oil was taxed at 50%. What Governor Parnell had proposed and others have proposed since then has been what's called a bracketed windfall profits tax. So at $40 of profit for a barrel of oil, you've received a handsome profit on your oil at that point, there would be a 10% profits tax surcharge. At $50 a barrel of profit, that would go up by 5%, but you'd only pay that additional 5% on that on the profit between $50 and $60 a barrel. And you do 5% at $60 and 5% at $70. And again, at $60, that extra 5% would only apply in the range of the $60 and $70 worth of profits on the barrel of oil. So in the end, you could have a 25% surcharge, but the overall tax on oil would not be an additional 25% because it's bracketed. It would be much lower. These are just incremental charges on the incremental value of oil. We've tried to achieve what we consider a fair and modest compromise, a higher gross tax at lower prices to protect us where we are right now, but also to be fair to the industry and also to recognize that if we get it wrong on a particular field, a company can get royalty relief, a modest profit tax at high prices, and one that recognizes that oil companies, when the price of oil goes up, we all benefit. If you're making $40 a barrel on a barrel of oil, you're in windfall profits range. You're doing well. We're happy for you. The state should share in it. So, I also have one alternative I wanted to have the committee consider. We have a proposal that says at $50 a barrel, the rate goes up to 5%, the gross minimum tax. And then it goes up at every $8 increase, at $58, at $66, at $74, at $82, and at $90 by 1%. We erred on the side of being conservative before we had modeling done on the bill. But the state share of the increase in a gross minimum tax would remain smaller than the overall revenue taken in by an oil company producer if we did it at every $6. And if we did it at every $6, and instead of going all the way up to 10%, just capped it at 8%. So just four additional brackets instead of six. So we did 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 and stopped at a maximum 8% gross minimum tax. But we did it at every $6 price increase. So at 56, at 62, at 68, 74. Next fiscal year, we would take in an extra $200 million in revenue. The state's share for that increase would allow for the producer also to take in extra profits and extra revenue that would be greater than the amount of money the state share would be. So their revenue share would be higher than the state's additional take I think that's the better proposal. I didn't want to put it in the bill until it was modeled. But that would be my personal recommendation, and not go all the way up to 10%, only go up to 8%.
Hmm. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah. This slideshow alluding to, it looks like we're, through the chair, I'm sorry. It looks like we're kind of alluding to progressivity and the word bracketing and all that. And then we refer back to ACEs a lot. Is it your guess, estimation that we should go back to ACEs?
Through the chair, no, it's my belief that we should learn from all the all-tech systems we've had in the past and come up with something that we think addresses the concerns that were valid made by whether it's current law or prior law, and take the best parts from those laws and take the best advice that we can get. So, no, I'm not saying that. And frankly, were that SB 21 initiative or referendum to pass, I would have proposed a different law back then, and I had, as a matter of fact.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
This is the alternative I was mentioning. It would be 5% at 50, 6% at 56, 7% at 62, 8% at 70, and cap out at 8%. And at that point, when the profits tax became bigger than the gross minimum, that would take over. $200 million in FY18. Instead of what you see that we're getting right now, which would be much less than $100 million after credits, I think it would allow us to start building the state again. I think it would allow us to pay back oil tax credits that we owe almost $1 billion in at this point. This state is deeply in the red, and I think this is one way, one component of coming up with a portion of a revenue plan that will help get us out of the red.
Representative Rauscher had a question.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, as we start to see more oil coming down the pipeline, wouldn't we all agree that more oil down the pipeline would probably be a large answer to part of the problem right now, wouldn't it, with the prices we have?
Through the chair. Yeah, I would like more oil down the pipeline. I don't think there's anybody in this committee that would disagree that we want more oil down the pipeline. I would disagree that it's in our greatest interest to have more oil come down the pipeline when it's paying a 0% production tax for the first 7 years, some of the most vibrant years of production on a field. I think we should take a look at that. Or a 4% tax after that.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the fiscal note for this in the package, it indicates that as we approach 2023, that's it'll goes from a couple hundred million a year up to over $300 million a year in additional revenue. We have a presumably declining throughput. So, is that a fair? You're looking at this as a basically a $300 million tax increase on the oil industry in one way or another.
Through the chair. When you're looking at those out years where it raises $300 million a year, that's only because oil companies are reaping in much larger profits. So you would be taking a share as oil companies are getting a share from higher oil prices. So that $300 million a year is at much higher prices than we have today. And I think an oil tax system should be written in a way where the state shares and industry shares in high oil prices.
Okay. Thank you.
A couple of, thank you, Chair. A couple other components of the bill. We've talked about the 0% production tax. We've talked about royalty relief. This gross value reduction, which reduces a company's tax payment to zero until about $70 a barrel for the first 7 years, and then by about 40% of the tax rate that other fields pay. This bill would eliminate that for large fields that are presumably much more profitable, 50,000 barrel fields. It recognizes that small, more challenged fields can still retain the GVR. And for those, the maximum GVR length that you get to benefit from the low tax rate would be 5 years instead of 7 years. Then there's Cook Inlet. Right now, there's a sunset, and I can't remember what year it sunsets, but under the current sunset, once that happens, Cook Inlet will pay a 35% profits tax. Today, they're paying essentially zero. Mr. Alper can explain the calculation that gets us to close to no production taxes in Cook Inlet. The credits we provided in Cook Inlet were intended to incentivize natural gas. But obviously, a number of companies, when they're searching for natural gas, find oil. Or maybe they were looking for oil. A production tax of near zero on Cook Inlet does not do the state very well. So this bill also says there should be a 22.5% tax just on profits in Cook Inlet. It doesn't propose a gross minimum tax in Cook Inlet. Only when companies become profitable, 22.5% is modest. And then that bracketed windfall profit surcharge would kick in at when a company achieves $40 a barrel in profits, which may never happen in Cook Inlet. Cook Inlet is a more challenged area, but if a company is reaping very, very, very huge profits in any area of the state should share, and the company should share in that high profit. So the bracketed windfall profit share would also be proposed to apply in Cook Inlet, but you need some tax, I believe, in Cook Inlet. Right now, Cook Inlet is all zeros. With that, I think I've gone through the bill. I think I've gone through all the components in the bill. There are a couple mistakes in the bill. One, a mistake in judgment on my part, and one, a mistake in drafting. The bracketed provision isn't written the way we intended, and so we've got an amendment to fix that if the committee decides to fix that technical error. We do not want to increase the tax on heavy oil. The gross minimum tax, we don't want to apply to heavy oil. We take the sort of Schrader Bluff and Agnew definition of heavy oil. Those are two heavy oil reservoirs. And we say any field that has oil that has a lower gravity than Agnew and Schrader Bluff would not be subject to the rising gross minimum tax. They would just be left at the existing gross minimum tax rate. And so those are the two amendments that we'd ask the committee to consider just to get the bill to be where we intended it to be in the first place.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Guerra, I was just wondering, have you taken a look at the tax bill that we have before us that was brought forward by our committee as HB 111? And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on it or how yours compares to that.
Through the chair. We purposely didn't address tax credits in our bill because we knew this committee was already working on that issue. So my opinion on that is this committee should decide the tax credit part of it. You've heard me say, I think if you have higher revenue, you can afford more in the way of paying for tax incentives. And if you have a system that produces less in revenue, you just can't afford it, even if you'd like to. But I'd let this committee decide what to do on tax credits. I do think that on the revenue side, there are two sides for when it comes to the state's fiscal health. One is what revenue we bring in, and one is what we do in terms of incentives. This bill addresses the revenue side of it, and I feel strongly that that the provisions that I proposed are ones that protect the fiscal health of the state and allow us to move forward in a more economically vibrant way while respecting company profits.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of the number of concerns have been brought forward, but one is that we're changing the tax policy again, and it seems to be almost a yearly event. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Thank you, through the chair. I have strong feelings on that. The two most unstable tax regimes you can have in the world are ones that are too high because we know that somebody will be fighting constantly to change that tax rate. That creates instability. The other kind of tax rate that is very unstable for industry is one that's too low. I'm sure that you're not going to get a lot of members of industry to come in here and complain about a tax rate that's too low, but it does affect investment decisions to know that when you have a tax rate that the public regards as vastly too low, it's going to change also. So we have one of the two kinds of very unstable tax systems right now. We have the one that's too low, that may be subject to an initiative, that may be subject to future legislation, and I think when you hit the sweet spot of a fair tax system, That's the best thing you can do, but we're not there in my view. You know, who gets to be blamed for changing the tax system? You know, for a few years, industry wanted to change it. For a few years, the public wanted to change it. I would rather end that by passing a bill like this so we don't keep fighting over the oil tax system and so that there's more certainty in the oil patch.
Representative Birch has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think we had stability with SB 21 as it sits there now, and I guess the one of the you brought up attracting investments, and I guess one of the comparisons I think we need to stand back and take a good solid look at is the cost of production in Alaska and the cost of production in competitive fields in Lower 48. You touched on a little bit about Lower 48 and royalties, but I think I've actually had a number of meetings, if you will, with the bankers who have invested in small producers that had every expectation that they were going to have the promises that were made vis-a-vis credits on their exploration costs, recovered. And indications are that it's a very, very competitive market out there for capital. And when you look at the cost of production in Alaska versus the cost of production in Lower 48, have you had any effort or taken any initiative to compare the cost, from Alaska versus another area that another jurisdiction, if you will?
Thank you.
In your work?
Thank you. Through the chair. Yes. I mean, in my work as a legislator, I can't tell you how many oil tax presentations I've seen from experts. And it's not as simple as just taking the cost, right? I mean, the cost of producing a shale oil field or the kind of field where sort of metaphorically you back up your pickup truck with a tiny little well and then you move it a year later and a year later and a year later, those costs are not insignificant. A company also looks for large pools of oil. Drilling a large pool of oil, all things being equal, is much more efficient than drilling for tiny amounts of oil with very large numbers of small wells. You can compare us to offshore oil production in the Gulf of Mexico. I can't tell you what the dollar per barrel cost of investing in offshore oil production is in the Gulf of Mexico. It is much higher than on land production. There is no simple answer as to where Alaska ranks in terms of cost, but when you have a profits tax, that sort of takes into account that equalizes for the fact that your costs might be higher. When you're in the world where we are right now, where the state is sort of gasping on revenue and charging a tax that I believe is way, way, way too low, one that, as I said, you can't live off 0% production taxes, I don't think. I think it sort of begs the question, should you fix it? But there's no two jurisdictions where you can come up with one comparison factor and say, aha, there are a lot of comparison factors.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gar, maybe you can refresh my memory. I'm looking at slide 6 here, and I see that with production tax and net the tax credits earned in the, we came out about negative $25 million. How did we do 2016?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, the prior analyses have sort of bothered me because they've measured oil production revenue compared to what we owe in tax credits, and those have been cumulative years of tax credits. But in prior years, we've owed more in tax credits than we've gotten in production taxes, I think, in 2017. I can't guarantee you that. I think 2017 might have been the first year where we owed more in tax credits than we got in production taxes. The state is hampered in its ability to pay them right now with these levels of oil production tax revenue. Very hampered. I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you. I can look up the rest. Appreciate it.
Any other questions for Representative Guerra? We do have Mr. Alper here in the audience, and
he could be available to take a few questions if that would be of interest to committee members. Yes, no, maybe. There were a couple of items that came up. I have a question for Mr. Alpern. We could at least get that on the record, see if he could explain a little bit about the difference in the costs that were discussed, and that will just be hopefully informative for all of us as we're looking at the numbers. Thank you, Mr. Alpern. If you could please put yourself on the record.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Ken Alpern, Director of the Tax Division, Department of Revenue. Earlier in the presentation today, a question came to Representative Guerra about the numbers of per barrel cost, transportation, CapEx, OpEx. Depending on the analysis, both of those numbers are from the current book, the Revenue Sources book. I would direct members to look at the Appendix E tables in the back several pages. The number that has $9.33 in transportation, that's our estimate for FY17, the current fiscal year. The other analysis that Representative Guerra showing $9.77, that's our estimate for FY18. So it's the same reference book. It's just depending on whether we're looking at the current year or next year. So this year, the total costs are going to be $40 and change. We are estimating, based on what we know about company behavior, the all-in cost will be about $43 next year. And last year, we thought the number for this year was going to be 46. That's the number you, Madam Chair, referenced. Basically, company efficiency measures, cutting back on their work, has reduced their per-barrel spending by about $5 a barrel for the current fiscal year.
And Mr. Alpern, I guess what I was trying to suggest, too, is that those changes might lag behind the actual change in price because the companies themselves can't respond sort of overnight to some of those price change, per barrel change changes, but, you know, sort of takes a little bit of time for adjustments to be made or, you know, workers to be laid off, things like that. And can you just talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Madam Chair, every year we reach out to industry and talk to them about a number of things, including their plans for work in the next year. So our data set really comes in September, October. That's what we'll work into the revenue source book. Inevitably, their mobilizations take with months or even a year's notice. So they have, and every company is going to be different, but they're going to ramp down their spending. They're going to react to a price change in their own way. You can't do it immediately because the resources are already mobilized. In some cases, it depends on their thoughts as to how long a price drop might last. If they think it's going to bounce back in a few months, they might not react at all. Once industry figured out that this wasn't going to immediately react with an upward bounce of price, the spending has followed. If you look at our own forecast from, say, the fall of 2014, when the prices first dropped, our forecast was the price drop, but it was going to be back up again to $100 by FY17. We realized soon thereafter that wasn't going to happen, and we have over time extended our negative outlook further. By the spring of 2016, we were looking at prices in the low 40s for the next 2 or 3 years. We've actually gone in the other direction. We're now looking at a little bit of an upward trend in prices, so the fall forecast is a little bit more optimistic than last spring's forecast.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Alpern, I guess the thing that I'm wrestling with is I'm reminded of a Saturday town hall that I attended in Anchorage, and there was a question about oil and gas, and I mentioned the Hammond doctrine of the one-third, 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 and I actually, although it may be heresy, I was somewhat dismissive of it because it's not written in stone. But with that sort of preface to my question, when I look at, it's really yours, but Representative Guerra reproduced it's the page that you're looking at. And I see, for example, 2018, our production tax of $230 million. I don't know whether I should ask, and I don't know how I can know, whether all in the industry received $710 million, or whatever 3 times 230 is, or whether I should say, no, this one-third, one-third is a weighted average, and I have to wait my turn. And my turn doesn't come up until we hit $100 a barrel. That's sort of the thing I'm, when I say my turn, I mean the state of Alaska's turn. That's the thing I'm sort of wrestling with. I do look at this and I say, wait a minute, we're supposed to be bringing in billions of dollars. Of course, that's not possible right now. And I don't know, I guess in summary, my question is, how do I know what the industry brought in 2018? Well, it's 2018. How do you take my point?
Sure. Through the chair, co-chair Josephson, to try to unpack that. The slide before you is the production tax. When we talk about total government take or total non-producer take, to use the chairman's language, that's the sum total of all the different taxes. And an oil company working in Alaska typically has five: our property tax, our production tax, our state corporate income tax, the royalty, of course, and then the federal corporate income tax. So it's the sum total of those as a share of, let's call it, divisible rents, of the total divisible profit from producing that oil, which is more or less production tax value with the royalty added back into it as part of the divisible total. So there's a slide that I showed in my earlier presentations that tried to track the share of the gross and how it moved around. It's harder to track the share of the net because we often don't know. I can provide you aggregated data on the sum total of producers for the last 10 years because we have a net profits tax. We know what was filed. We don't have any real knowledge of what a company's profits were or weren't in 1995, for example, because we weren't requiring that information. Even to try to tease it out of the corporate income tax filings would be hard because of the nature of the apportionment formulas and the complexity of that particular tax. I suppose we have this window of data from roughly 1978 to 1981 where the corporate income tax used a separate accounting mechanism where we could probably learn something about company profits if anyone still has the 1979 taxes somewhere.
Follow up, Representative Josephson.
I mean, I don't mean to sound too conniving, but couldn't someone, because Conoco is required to produce that data, couldn't someone back out the number of barrels they put through taps and then figure out whether other companies had similar types of profits? Wouldn't that be something that could be done with relative ease?
Through the chair, probably. We're talking about the years before 2006, so we'd have to know the breakdown of ownership. You know, let's say Conoco is 30% of the average North Slope or something like that, so we'd need to back out what the other 70% was. I suppose that would be possible, at least within an order of magnitude. There's always going to be differences among the producers based on their corporate structure, what investments they're making at that moment in history, that sort of thing.
And follow?
No, thank you.
Okay. Representative Westlake.
Yes, and through the chair, thank you. I recognize Mr. Elper. No, go ahead. This is not your slides, but if you can manipulate that and go two pages up over to page 8 on there, you're nodding your head in agreement that you understood this, the discrepancy we had been talking about earlier.
So, through the chair, Representative Westlake, that was the initial question that the Chair Tarr asked me. The numbers referenced here, 977 and transport 3364, that is our current forecast for the average spending in FY 2018. The snapshot here is an analysis that Representative Garrett asked my agency for back in the fall, maybe it was December, to sort of take that average data and assuming the other features of our tax system, calculate the average effective tax rate at a variety of price points. So this table is reproduced from a letter we provided Representative Garrett in January or early February, and the full letter is in the backup pack of supporting documents that he put in the committee packet.
And a follow-up, Representative Westlake.
Thank you. And I can see a lot of it. You know, we hear we've got more taxes credits going out than we do have coming in, and I understand that. I can see why we'd want to revisit it, but is there also the royalty oil that's coming in that we don't talk about? Are those numbers difficult to get?
Through the chair, not at all, Representative Westlake. The royalty revenue is fully documented. We report it. It's in our revenue sources books. Throughout most of history, it's been easy to assume the royalty is going to be there for all of the oil. We were fortunate that Prudhoe and Kuparuk and the major finds were discovered on top of land that had been selected by the state after statehood as state lands. That is going to be inherently less true going into the future because of the successes that we're seeing in NPRA and eventually offshore and hopefully someday ANWR, which are production that's not on state-owned land, so we won't be getting the same share of royalty from that production.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Parrish, and then Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So at 1:40, I really perked up in my seat because Representative Garrett told us that in its reports, BP deducted Deepwater Horizon costs from Alaska profits. Do you have any familiarity with that?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I do not. I don't have any specific information to answer that question.
Well,
follow up?
Sure, and this could be for Representative Garrett as well. I just ask that that I be provided with a little bit more information on that because it seems bizarre to me.
Through the chair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Representative Parrish.
And, can you state your name? Just
Yeah, Representative Guerra again. Representative Parrish, what I was trying to say was you can't really rely on the BP annual reports for an accurate rendition of their Alaska profits because God knows how they calculate them. In 1 year, they had deducted some of their Deepwater Horizon costs. They're not allowed to deduct those from, like, the corporate tax they pay here. If they're paying the gross minimum tax of 4%, there are no deductions other than the net operating loss, which could take us below zero, I guess. But in Alaska, they would not be able to deduct their Deepwater Horizon costs, except for, I guess Mr. Albert could talk about how the sort of funky way our corporate tax system works, which is worldwide apportionment. So I guess we would be paying a little bit but in large part, they are not allowed to deduct their Deepwater Horizon costs from Alaska's taxes. And we're in minimum tax world right now. So,
thank you. Thank you.
And while we're on this, Mr. Alper, this is an issue that has not come up before. If you could briefly describe what Representative Guerra was just mentioning about the worldwide apportionment issue.
Sure. Ken Alper again, Madam Chair. The way the corporate income tax works in Alaska, and it's pretty much the same in all states, is there's a global income number, how much did they make across the world. And what the taxes they pay in Alaska are not the profits they made in Alaska. It's the amount they made in the world multiplied by a series of ratios tied to the ratio of Alaskan activity to global activity, their payroll ratio, their property value ratio, their extraction factor, the production. So that creates a formula which is multiplied through and applies to the corporate income tax. That's true both of the so-called regular corporate income tax for non-oil and gas companies and the somewhat special and different formula we have for oil and gas companies. The effect of that, on average, is a little bit less than the statutory tax rate. So if you look at the corporate income tax statutes in 4320, the top rate is 9.4% of profits. What we've learned based on a track record of many years is at this moment in history, the average oil and gas company is paying the equivalent of about 6.5% of their profits to the state of Alaska. So the short answer there is the net effect of that multiplier is that we're a little bit of a below the mean type calculation for the state of Alaska. And that's why you sometimes hear talking about going back to this idea of separate accounting, which would at least in theory bring us back to the 9.4 statutory rate.
Representative Parrish, any follow-up to that?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it was 6 point what? Was what's actually paid?
On average, it's really through the chair, Representative Parrish, a modeling convention. We presume about 6.5%. And what, for modeling purposes, what we'll do is we'll say this is the income, the production tax value. This is the production tax paid, which is deductible from that. The amount that's left after the production tax is what we calculate the corporate income tax on. Okay. And then to go further, after subtracting the corporate income tax, what's left after that, that's what you would calculate the federal corporate income tax on.
And follow up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're getting about 3% less on the corporate income tax than the statute would seem to indicate. Is that right?
Through the chair, on average, it's going to vary from company to company. Each one has their own circumstances and ratios, but that's what we've learned in recent history, that's what the corporate income tax actually does bring in based on the apportionment factors, yes.
Follow-up?
And a follow-up?
Thank you. In the global apportionment formula, Does it take into account the higher average quality of Alaskan oil? I understand that we've got a lot of pretty low gravity oil as contrasted with tar sands and what have you that is prevalent in other parts of the world.
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I'm not going to pretend to know the answer to that question. I don't consider myself an expert on Alaska's corporate income tax. I'm relatively new to that. If I knew questions were going in that direction, I would have had someone on the line to be prepared to answer such a question. But we will get back to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Josephson.
Just to clarify, Director Opper, when you said that we're getting less than statutorily designated, it's not that something improper is happening. That's just the formula at the present time, right, because of these worldwide deductions and the apportionment and that sort of thing.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, exactly right. The formula happens to work out that if, for example, Alaska, if you look at the global share of income, let's say it's $1 billion, and Alaska is 10% of a company's income, $100 million, if the share of, say, property they own in Alaska is less than a tenth of their global property, that will reduce the multiplier in some way. Those kind of factors.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Through the chair, at some point, so there are a couple of pieces I left out, and then you would ask the question about what slides were different, and I just wanted to hit on those. Is this a good time to do that?
Let's just hold that for one moment and see if there are any other questions for Mr. Alper at this time. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I'm still hung up on this global apportionment issue. It seems to naturally follow that if we're being paid less than we would otherwise because of this formula, somebody else must be getting paid more. Does that seem to follow?
Representative Parrish, intuitively, through the chair, that makes sense. What I would recommend is the deputy director of the tax division, who is an authentic expert in the corporate income tax, is coming down this week for work in another committee. And I would recommend getting an appointment in your office, and you could talk through these issues in far greater detail than I can help you with.
Thank you. I see my aide taking notes on the subject. Thank you.
Brandon Spanos is his name. And if anyone who is sitting near him is listening in, let him know to look up Representative Parrish when he gets to Gina.
And I'll just add that in the past, Representative Seaton has had a bill on this very topic, and there's a presentation that we'll make available to members to study up. If I'm remembering correctly, the monetary value of that over the years adds up to about $6 billion in difference between worldwide and separate accounting. And I don't know, Mr. Alper, if you have that number in your head.
Madam Chair, so in 1978, the legislature changed Alaska to a separate accounting-based system, and it was one that was adjudicated through the court system. It was strongly, and it did greatly increase our revenue take at the time. Now, at the time, in 1978, we had a lot of production and relatively low infrastructure because we were brand new to the oil business. A lot of stuff simply hadn't been built yet. The multipliers were strongly in our favor. What I'm told is the multipliers are shifting towards a break-even from that. Like Representative Parrish said, we're at about two-thirds, and we were probably at about one-third or one-quarter back then. There is concern from within my own agency that if we went back to separate accounting, it would be something fairly easy to game. The sophistication of the taxpayers' accountants is more so than it was 30, 40 years ago. For example, let's just use a simple example. A major operator in Alaska could sell all of their Alaskan operations to a subsidiary based in Washington State and lease them back for $5 billion a year. For corporate income tax, separate accounting purposes, they're now operating at a loss. So that's the sort of thing we would need to make sure to avoid if we were going in that direction. I honestly have no idea what the cumulative impact is. We did, Representative Seaton had a bill in the last legislature that would have gone to separate accounting. We did some rudimentary analysis in the fiscal note. I think it was in the neighborhood of a couple hundred million dollars a year in the relatively recent history that it might have raised, presuming nothing else changed. It's hard to make that assumption, given the example I just did.
Thank you, Mr. Alper. And Representative Johnson, did you have a question for Mr. Alper?
Actually, I had a request of the chair.
Okay.
I was just wondering if we could hear from the Competitiveness Review Board was brought up, and I was just wondering if we might be able to hear from them with one
We do not have any plans to hear from them, but we can certainly look into that and assess their availability and whereabouts, because there was some delay in their work after the new administration took place, and I need to get up to speed on actually whether they're fully appointed group at this time. But definitely appreciate the consideration, and we'll let all the committee members know what we find out on that point. Did you have a comment, Mr. Alper?
Madam Chair, the Competitiveness Review Board's report from late in 2015, I think, has been made available to the committee. The most recent project on their so-called cycle would have been a Cook Inlet analysis. They chose to defer that because of the major changes to Cook Inlet taxation made last year, largely in this committee. They have started the process, the Competitiveness Reviewer, of hiring an outside contractor to look at various pieces of legislation and how they might compare and contrast Alaska's competitiveness. That's a project that is just getting started. I don't believe there will be any sort of results for a few weeks, so I would doubt that there's much of interest that's extremely timely that could be brought to the committee now, although later in session I think there will be at least a draft report to bring forward.
Thank you. We'll sort of follow up and confirm all of that and then report back. Any other questions for Mr. Alper? Okay, thank you for joining us on the spot like that. And I was able to just find the bill from Representative Seaton that was from the last legislature is House Bill 191, and the presentation that I was referring to is uploaded on BASIS for anyone who's wanting to learn more about that particular topic. Representative Guerra, you had a couple of corrections that you wanted to make.
Thank you, through the chair. First, you had asked, so we had added a couple of slides that were not in your hard copy packets. They're basically the last three slides in here on Cook Inlet and a couple of other things. We can certainly get you those last three pages. Two things that I forgot to mention. As we discussed before, the state will contract for a higher royalty on a field that it believes has the potential to be more profitable. When I was on the Finance Committee, when the current law passed, with very little discussion, an amendment was introduced to reduce the production taxes on those fields to sort of make them even with overall government take to the 12.5% fields. So there's a GVR provision that lowers the production tax for 16% royalty fields. I personally didn't think that was a great idea, and in this bill we eliminate that benefit. If it's a higher profit field, we don't see the reason to lower the production tax. And then just finally, this is the sort of gross minimum tax, how it would step up and really never get to the sort of North Dakota and Louisiana levels. But then subtract about 0.4 from this tax that will be paid to the state of Alaska, because, and you've probably discussed this in this committee, the taxes that are paid to the state of Alaska, 35% of them are deductible from the company's federal corporate income tax. So we can sort of piggyback a little bit on the federal government's decision not to accept as much of a share as it could. But if we raise taxes by 3%, we're really raising them by 2%, because the company then gets that much bigger of a federal deduction. And the way our corporate tax works, you get to deduct your production taxes from your state corporate tax too. So you get two deductions for any tax increase. And so any tax increase here really should be viewed as really only about 0.6 of what it looks like, because about 0.4 of that the company doesn't really pay. That's the only other thing I wanted to mention.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Representative Josephson has a question.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. As I said earlier, I share your concerns about the ban of prices between $50 and $80, roughly $90. But and the caveat is the obvious, and that is I don't represent the industry, and so I don't know what their I sort of know what their response would be. But it seems like one of the things they'd say is the but that is to our advantage is that Louisiana is stuck at 13%, and we have an opportunity to get theoretically at 35% if it was $170 a barrel. This is that patience game I was talking about, and what is your response to that?
Through the chair, we have the duty to represent our constituents now. What we know now is that nobody in the world anticipates world record oil prices of the $160 a barrel that it would take to get the profits tax under current law up to 35%. In my view, that's a mythical tax rate, because it would have, there's never been an oil price in the history of the world that would have gotten us there. If you were looking at protecting the next decade of a future for the people of the state of Alaska, so we can afford a vibrant university system and schools that our children can thrive in, when I personally believe parents are wondering about whether or not to raise their kids in the state anymore. I think you have to look at the near term, whether you count that as 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. This bill protects us over those next 10 years. And if we don't do this and we say, well, let's not do this because in 30 years prices might be $160 a barrel, we've lost a whole generation, in my view, a whole generation of revenue. And this is revenue we need now for reasons that I think this committee understands.
Thank you.
A follow-up? Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Through the chair, that's just kind of confusing to me, because in one, it seemed like earlier we were saying we needed to fix it for good. When it was brought up that we have changing all the time and we're confusing the producers and making it harder for them to want to play and harder for them to work with it, and then we go and we say, well, we need to make it work for now instead of across the field for later. Like, I might have gotten the inference from what Coach Jefferson was saying. So I guess I'm just trying to figure out where we are with where you're going.
May I answer that, Madam Chair?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Rauscher. You're right. I don't think that you should develop a partial oil tax system, because you're just going to have to come back and revisit it again. So in this bill, we've addressed the low price problem of the 0% production taxes on GVR oil, the 4% gross minimum tax that we live on until $74 a barrel. So that's the for the next 10 years problem. But we also address the next 30-year problem by also addressing the fair share we should be getting when companies are in windfall profits range. So this bill has both provisions. One provision that probably won't kick in for many, many years, which is when companies are in the windfall profits range, what should our share be? And one provision for what we do now. And so it's intended to be stable across all prices, and to be less aggressive than ACES was at high prices, but to be stable across all prices rather than focusing on just now or just later.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? We do have Susie Schutz from Legal Services also on the line, if anyone has questions about the legislation or questions that would be directed to Ledge Legal. Any other questions for Representative Guerra or Mr. Alper, who has not left the room yet? So that's what happens when you stay. Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Guerra. Do you have any closing comments for us?
Madam Chair, only if the committee had the patience and were willing to move ahead at some point. I'd hate to have a piece of legislation sitting out there that isn't what I intended, and so I had those two amendments that would just better reflect what we meant by the bill, to not increase the tax on heavy oil. And the bracketing was, as Susie's online to explain that in part, that we just didn't get the bracketing language right in the bill. So,
if you would please share that with the co-chair's offices, then we'll absolutely make sure that everybody sees that in the very near future.
Thank you.
Okay. Just to review sort of where we are and what is happening for this week. We wanted to hear House Bill 133 today because our intention is to just have one bill that comes out of the committee. And this way it was an opportunity to hear some of these other options for consideration prior to, you know, working on amendments for the bill that we've been hearing the last couple of weeks, House Bill 111. So that was the purpose of today's hearing, to, you know, these are some ideas that aren't currently in House Bill 111, to make sure folks, you know, had an opportunity to hear those ideas before we move into the next phase of 111. This evening, we have the public testimony starting at 6:30. I don't have a good way of anticipating what the turnout might be, but you know, if we can get through public testimony tonight, then hopefully that will time will allow for that. But if there are, you know, more than 60 people signed up again, then we'll probably have to continue public testimony on to another evening so that we're not here till midnight. So we'll try to just stick with that kind of two-hour time block and see how far that gets us. What we've done is schedule several meetings over the remaining days of the week that would give us enough time to hopefully get through our work on House Bill 111. However, what we did with that schedule was build in what we thought was probably a little extra time to give us some flexibility so that members don't feel rushed. So on Wednesday, it happens to be that that's when Alyeska Pipeline Service is going to be in town for the 40th anniversary of TAPS event. And so we've invited them as part of the 111 presentation to come talk to us first at 1 o'clock and give us some perspective on throughput and the challenges with low production and sort of the technology that they're using and an update on their new operator for, you know, safely bringing tankers in and out. So hopefully that will be very timely just to get a bit of perspective, because that's one thing we haven't talked about. Moving forward from that, what I'd like to do is be able to visit with members over this afternoon and tomorrow to see what schedule works best. Also keeping in mind that Ledge Legal needs a little bit of lead time to work on things. So if it seems like it would be too big of a push to start amendments on Wednesday, then we can delay that until Thursday. And even we have Friday and Saturday meetings scheduled as well. And so want to just come around and talk to folks individually to see, you know, what schedule works best for folks to, you know, make sure they feel ready and not rushed, and as well as Ledge Legal be able to prepare things. Because we sent the announcement out last Thursday about amendments this Wednesday, and so meeting that 24-hour deadline would be by tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and that's the deadline I'm not sure that people are going to be able to meet. And so that's why you saw so many meetings on the schedule this week, so we could have some flexibility in moving forward and make sure that folks felt like they had enough time to have all the questions addressed. If we need additional public testimony, we also have an evening meeting on Wednesday scheduled, and that I think would be the meeting we would carry over the public testimony to. So hopefully that gives us enough time to both get through public testimony and you know, be able to have enough meeting time scheduled that if we have many amendments, you know, and of course every member is encouraged to bring as many as are necessary to address your issues and concerns, that we've also built enough time into the schedule for that. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Chair. Just through the clarification,
mm-hmm.
Are we still holding the 1 o'clock deadline tomorrow?
I think we can push that until 1 o'clock on Wednesday.
Okay, thank you.
Because we'll have the Alyeska Pipeline presentation, and if we don't have additional testimony, then we won't have an evening meeting on Wednesday, and we'll move to Thursday.
All right, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And again, like I say, we're going to come around and visit with folks, but really want to make sure that, you know, people don't feel rushed or unprepared for the amendments that they would like to offer, and so we hope to be able to accommodate that, but also recognizing that we hit the 45-day mark last Thursday, that, you know, we need to kind of complete our work so we can keep a bill, you know, should a bill pass out of our committee, moving forward onto the next committee of referral.
Thank you.
In the meantime, we'll also, Representative Johnson, follow up on your suggestion and request about the Competitiveness Review Board. And Thatcher, if we could please make sure that we have the most recent report that was completed made available and posted online, we'll do that. And so if they're not available to speak with us, at least we'll have the most recent report that they issued. Okay. Representative Birch.
Well, I personally, thank you, Madam Chair, I personally am ready to vote no on this right now, but to the extent that we have already gone through what I thought was a conclusion of public hearing, we had public hearing last week, and I think we
We waited till the last dog died. I think everybody got to testify. And I guess I was somewhat surprised to see seven more meetings scheduled when we've actually had the luxury of I think we had a meeting on ocean acidification. We had a meeting on the Pebble Project. So we've actually, you know, tossed a couple of extra meetings in there. But, you know, for my view, you know, I guess I don't know what the expectation is that there's going to be, you know, but seven more meetings seems a little excessive to me, looking at the time schedule, looking at what we have to do in you know, coming downstream in the next half of this legislative session. So, you know, to the extent that you're going to go out and ask anybody, my vote is let's move on this rather than scheduling seven more meetings.
Well, thank you, Representative Birch. I appreciate the comments. We did leave public testimony open, and we lost some people throughout that evening because it, you know, went on so long and they weren't able to testify. And one of our, as the co-chairs, one of our real commitments is to try and make the public testimony portion available. And this evening, if we don't have individuals signed up to testify, then we, you know, we'll end the meeting. But because we lost some people and because it, you know, we couldn't just keep going that evening until 9 or 10 o'clock. At one point, I cut people off from signing up. If you'll recall, about 6:40 p.m., we said, if you're not signed up already. And so I just don't feel comfortable, you know, having made that announcement in the middle of the meeting but not providing an additional opportunity. And on the other meetings, it is quite a number of meetings, but we had to get the schedule in, and we wanted to, you know, accommodate so many new members and not have folks feel like, you know, they had to kind of rush to get something done and weren't totally prepared. So that was really out of respect for members to, you know, basically schedule extra meetings if they were needed, but we're not going to have them if they're not necessary. But I don't want time limitation to be, you know, if you have 25 amendments you want to offer, then we should give you the time to offer those 25 amendments. And that's the part that I don't, you know, don't sort of know what everybody's wishes are. But we want to make sure that everybody has the time and gets the full ear and attention of the committee members to hear those ideas. Does that help? Sort of clear that part up?
Shorter the better.
Okay, appreciate that. Representative Josephson, did you have a comment? Okay. Okay, well, then, Representative Birch, you will appreciate we are finishing 17 minutes early today, and in legislative time, that's like an eternity, so enjoy. 16 minutes, I'm going to gavel out now.